ball towards left field. Going back fast is Kennedy. Kennedy gets there, and he takes it. And the Cleveland Indians are the world champions of 1948. And they are leaping joyously as they go off the field. Din is being mobbed, as are Lou Boudreau. And out in center field, Tucker and Kennedy come running in arm in arm.
Little tap up in the air, third base side, waiting is Tomy. Foul territory, the game is over. And the Indians have won the divisional title. Indian fans have waited 41 years. And now they can really cheer.
Now the pitch.
Swung on, line to deep left field. It is gone! You should see the celebration out of the Indians' third base dugout. Rajay Davis, a bullet, two-run homer down the left field line, clearing the 19-foot wall. We are tied at six.
This is Our Tribe History, presented by Progressive. A regular look back at professional baseball history in Cleveland since 1901 and beyond. Now, here's your host, Indians team historian Jeremy Fedor.
Welcome to another episode of Our Tribe History, presented by Progressive. I am your host, team historian Jeremy Fedor. And on this episode, we are going to continue with part two of our podcast on the 1910 Chalmers race between Knapp Lajoie and Detroit's Ty Cobb. And so when we left off last week, or was it 2 weeks, the Knapp was reinvigorated. He had dropped the role as manager and was a new ball player for Cleveland at 35 years old. Best days were behind him, but he still had a little bit left in the tank. Once season started midway through April, Larry actually had a pretty great April, batting .432, knocking out 19 hits in 12 games. When May started, the paper noted that Napoleon Lajoie, showing old-time form, leads American League hitters. Now, could Knapp keep up that blistering pace? Not quite, but throughout the season he had ups and downs, much like any other hitter in the league. And by May 15th, he hit one of those small snags, and he was hitting below 300 for a week. The paper said, despite his batting slump of the last week, Knapp Lajoie continues to lead the hitters of the American League with an average of .425. Davy Jones of Detroit, who has played in only 12 games, is second with a .364. Harry Lord, captain of the White Red Sox, is really second with .344, followed closely by Speaker, Wallace, Cobb, and Crawford. And by May 22nd, the paper was again, remarking on Knapp's average, it said, Napoleon Lajoie is the only American League player who has a batting average of over .400. Lajoie's mark when Thursday's game was ended was at .433. Throughout that season, the Plaindale was compiling averages of both the Knapp's team and players in the league, and it makes sense because, obviously, in 1910, you didn't have Baseball Reference or any other website to visit to calculate that for you. You had to rely on the newspaper, and if you were a fan of Tris Speaker or someone on a different team, it was nice that the local paper would publish that for you. And by May 29th, towards the end of that month, it said, Cleveland club is again last in batting, the Athletics leading. 300 list now comprises 13 players, Lajoie first in being the Knapp's sole representative. So not much of a season going for the Cleveland Knapps at that point. But overall, in the month of May, Knapp recorded 33 hits in 85 at-bats, 4 doubles, a triple, 11 RBI, and 3 home runs. And he only struck out twice. So he was sitting at .406 for the season. In June, Ty Cobb started to heat up. And on the June 4th paper, it said, Ty Cobb is coming strong, but a certain distinguished Clevelander of the name of Lajoie continues to lead the procession. And like I said, the Cleveland Club wasn't necessarily a great team in 1910, and it was usually reflected in the writer's stories. On June 5th, the paper said, "Why not let Lajoie play first, second, and third base, and shortstop, and come to bat four times instead of once out of nine?" So again, the team really couldn't hit, and you kind of had the polar opposites. You had Lajoie, who was at that time the best hitter for that season, and then the team that couldn't even muster up another player over 300. As June continued onward, many of the stories that were run in the paper really focused on Knapp, because, you know, when you didn't have a winning team, you kind of wanted to at least focus on the positive. And it covered both his good days and his bad days. So in the June 22nd paper, it said Lajoie had a bad day at bat. But then by June 26th, it said pitchers fear Lajoie when at bat. As a result, he's often passed. So again, pitchers were walking him, and Baseball Reference doesn't have the intentional walks yet on their database. But nevertheless, they didn't really mess around with Lajoie. And you could get away with that because Cleveland wasn't a very good team in 1910, so kind of just worked your way around him when you could. And again, by the end of the month, the race was heating up. On June 26th, the paper said, "Both hitting harder. Automobile prize tends to help averages of Lajoie and Cobb. The additional prize of an automobile has caused Knapp, Lajoie, and Ty Cobb to slug more ferociously this year than last. And the pace which these two natural pounders are setting is proving much too fast for good hitters like Harry Lord, Eddie Collins, and several others. Tris Speaker is the only other batter who is keeping anywhere near up." So by the end of June, Knapp tallied 35 hits in 93 at-bats with 7 doubles, 5 RBI, striking out 0 times, and accumulating a .376 batting average for the month. And we roll on into July, and as was mentioned in our previous podcast with our guest Rick Hune, who you'll hear from later on in this episode, scorekeeping wasn't the science it is today. It wasn't as standardized. It was kind of a little more loosey-goosey. And the newspaper said that there have been charges and countercharges of favoritism in scoring in the cases of Lajoie and Cobb, the two rivals for possession of the championship automobile. And it would seem as if Knapp Lajoie himself yesterday wanted to show the Tigers the most convincingly that he had earned every one of his hits. So again, Knapp going out there and making some clean hits that can't be argued. Again, more of the ball don't lie expression, and not trying to put it out there that he's been complaining and trying to get favorable scorekeeping from the home crowd. And by July, there's no hope for the Cleveland team winning AL. So you see fans begin to focus their attention solely on Lajoie. And here in the paper, it said, "But this year, Cleveland has little or no hope for a championship. Cleveland pride and Cleveland enthusiasm are not given so much for baseball, for the baseball club, as for one man, Larry Lajoie, the big Frenchman, who is making a splendid fight for the batting championship of America. This year, he is the old Lajoie, the greatest and most scientific of all ball players. Every baseball lover in Cleveland is praying that he may continue his good work and prove that the complacent Georgian, Ty Cobb, has been grievously overrated." And one picture I'm going to tweet out is the Plain Dealer ran this little picture, and it's just Knapp's eyes. And I forget the caption, it's on my desktop, but it's like the eyes of the best batter in baseball. And it's actually kind of scary, but I'll tweet that out. And throughout July, the paper records Knapp's progress or lag thereof. July 9th, Lajoie popped out twice in the second game. That sort of luck kills the batting average pretty rapidly. Mentions the next day that he couldn't get a hit off a pitcher named Fred Olmsted, a White Sox pitcher. So again, his numbers weren't doing great. And when, again, Lajoie didn't have runners on, they'd pitch around him and often walk him. Then by July 18th, Lajoie's grip on the automobile looked a little bit tighter or looser than it had been in the past. And the paper said, "Lajoie has no option of auto. Cobb is 8 points behind Knapp. Speaker is close. The Honorable Mr. Lajoie, leading Noble of the Naps, has no option on that seven-seated touring car, which a certain automobile firm will donate to the best batter in the major leagues the middle of the approaching October. A month ago, everyone was ready to believe that he had notified the auto people where to deliver the machine, but in view of the subsequent events, he probably did not. Despite his slump, Clevelanders are placing their faith in Lajoie to win the auto. He has been meeting the ball consistently since April 14th, too much so to remain in his present state of inactivity. And on a side note, during this 1910 meh season, Tuscarawas County native and Cleveland ball-playing legend Cy Young recorded his 500th victory, and that was on July 19th, where Knapp won a cool 2-for-5 to help his buddy Cy Young. And later on, there's a photograph of, and this is neither here nor there, just something that popped into my mind. At my desk, I have with a printout, but it's Knapp, Cy Young, and Tris Speaker all in suits talking at the opening of Municipal Stadium. And it's a cool picture. And man, you can't imagine the stories that these guys could probably tell each other. And you could sit down with all three of them now, I'm sure you'd get some pretty wild stuff, especially back in those days. So, but three great Cleveland legends, and again, the stories that they could tell. But back to 1910, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. And by July 20th, you start to see in the Plain Dealer what they called the auto chasers clip in the paper. And that focused on the top, I think it was around 10 guys, 10 leading batters competing for, obviously, the Chalmers. So you start seeing that a lot more. And the paper start to also go deeper into Lajoie's successes and struggles. And by July 31st, it said, Lajoie is forced to sacrifice self when the hit-and-run signal is given. All that will be necessary to pull Knapp Lajoie's batting average down to 300 or less will be for the Naps to pursue the same policy as they did in yesterday's game with St. Louis. Four times Lajoie went to bat with men on bases, and each time the hit-and-run signal was given. Three times he was outguessed by the opposition and actually forced to throw his bat at balls. So again, it wasn't just about Knapp. He was trying to be a team player, and you didn't want to cross up signals and get your guys thrown out. But at the same time, it was hurting his average when he was swinging at balls out of the strike zone that he couldn't drive for base hits. And on the same day of the July 31st paper, it ran the headline, Ty Cobb now leads in both the number and length of safeties. Tris Speaker passes Lajoie in slugging during this week, but is still behind Knapp in the general average. So in July, Knapp seemed to be tiring a little bit. He only batted at 303, 37 hits and 122 at-bats, 9 doubles, 3 triples, and 11 RBI. So by August 1st, again, it was Knapp's average was taking a little bit of a dip. Paper also said that it is said by the baseball critics that Larry Lajoie is a victim of the hit-and-run game. So is James R. Garfield. That style of play fattens no averages and wins no automobiles or governorships. James R. Garfield being the son of the former president. I'm not necessarily sure his political history, but again, Knapp kind of worked his way into a lot of stories. And later on, there's a story, and I didn't actually write it down, but it's in my head right now, that Knapp, there was a young lady getting onto a train. They were going somewhere to one of the ball games and ripped her skirt. And the porter went through and was asking other women if they had a sewing kit, something to fix it. No one. So they went to the next cart and or box car, whatever you call them, and asked. And sure enough, Knapp Lajoie was carrying a mending kit in his travel bag. And the young lady was able to fix her skirt. So Knapp seemed to find his way into stories here and there throughout that 1910 season. And by the end of August, it said, the race for batting honors is close. Although Tyrus Cobb leads, he is expected to be hard-pressed. Many look for Lajoie to strike his stride when the team returns. That August looked a little better than July. He had 338 with 44 hits and 130 at-bats, 11 RBI, 11 double, and that put him at 355 for the season. Now by September 4th, the headline, Lajoie gained some on Ty Cobb. Detroiter made but 4 hits last week to 9 for Napoleon. So again, you start seeing more headlines that were just focused on those two players, you know, just kind of ignore the team and focus on what really matters at this point, this exciting race for this automobile. And in an era when not everyone had a car, it was a big deal for these players to be winning such a grandiose prize. September 6th, the paper said Lajoie passes Cobb in the race for the auto by making 5 hits in 6 games at bat, while Ty Cobb was going hitless yesterday. Nat Lajoie succeeded in wrestling the first honors in batting from the Georgian, who had been leading the Nap for the last 6 weeks. So again, this race is going back and forth. But there didn't seem to be any bad blood between the two, because on the September 13th paper, it said, talk about enmity between two rivals. Ty Cobb happened along about 2 o'clock this afternoon and took Lajoie out to Bennett Park in his automobile. So Ty already has an automobile anyway, but the two shared a ride from wherever Lajoie and Cobb were staying. And then a couple days later, about a week later, September 18th, goes into play about the scores again. Another one of these articles, which is kind of, in hindsight, you know, oddly coincidental, I guess, said Lajoie lets scores alone. Nap star believes official tabulators know their own business. Tim Mernon, the veteran baseball writer, pays his compliments to Nap Lajoie as follows. The race for what automobile in the American League is growing interest, with Cobb, Lajoie, and Speaker running along close together. I doubt a Speaker ever thinks of the matter. He certainly never gives one of the impressions that he is after the prize, as he never inquires after his record, which just the reverse in the case of Ty Cobb, who knows every official scorer and usually knows the number of hits he has been given credit for before he goes to bed at night. And if the official scorer fails to give Mr. Cobb all the doubtful ones, the Flying Georgian becomes real peevish. Larry Lajoie would like to win the car, but you never hear of this great player questioning the abilities of the scorers. And Knapp ended up tearing it up in September with a cool .456 average, 41 hits in 90 at-bats, 16 doubles, and 11 RBI. And here we'll go back to Rick, and he'll give us some more information on the batting race.
So it came down to these two players, and it actually went back and forth between Cobb and Lajoie throughout the year. Nobody really knew for sure when those averages came out into the newspapers how accurate they were. So, you know, we're just kind of going along with whatever newspaper you happened to look at that day. So there were some discrepancies, and as I found out, in going through the newspaper records, the archives, there were some fairly significant discrepancies depending on who you looked at and what you listened to, as far as who you were talking to on any particular day. Neither the Tigers of 1910 or the Naps were vying for the title as we entered October, early October. So what it really came down to was that this particular race, and specifically the race between Lajoie and Cobb, became of national interest. There'd never been an automobile offered in this fashion. Automobiles were very much coming into existence and popularity, and they were prized possessions. Here you had the old and the new. You had the new and Cobb, feisty, one of the scrappiest ball players of all time, disliked by many of the his fellow ball players for the way he played ball, loved by the Tigers fans, but not particularly loved anywhere else in the American League. And then you had Lajoie, who had been with the American League since its inception in 1901, fairly well liked by everyone, and much more popular with his fellow baseball players and the fans around the league. So you're going into early October, and again, this has caught the national interest. Actually, maybe more interest in this batting race. The newspapers are printing the daily Cobb-Lajoie statistics. When you look at the old papers, you'll see it says automobile race, and many of them, there's a little box up at the top of the first page of the sports page, and they have the statistics, who's leading on that particular day, games remaining, whatever. And these players meet for their last time, the Tigers and the Naps, in Detroit on October 4th. So when they get to the ballpark, they find a Chalmers automobile sitting there and a slew of photographers wanting to take pictures. And they're all clamoring for one of the players to get behind the steering wheel, and the other one can get in the back seat. And they're going to take photographs that are going to appear throughout the country. So they're at Bennett Park. Neither Cobb nor Lajoie, despite what I fully believe was their intense interest in winning the car and being considered the best player in baseball, neither one wants to get behind the steering wheel. And they both act like they could care less about this. It was no big deal, bothersome. Ty said, Knapp, you do it, I'll get in the back. Knapp said, no, you get in there, Ty. And it ended up that both of them got in the back seat because neither one would get behind the steering wheel. And it became a famous picture. In fact, I decided that that's what I wanted to have if the publisher was interested on the cover.
As Rick was saying, both players were featured in that car, and that was on October 6th in the Plain Dealer, so the day before, obviously, and said, before the game, Lajoie and Cobb sat in the prize auto side by side and were photographed. They seemed to worry less about the prize than did the spectators. And also, to what Rick said, Lajoie was a little more beloved than Cobb, and you see that too on October 2nd when Cleveland was in Chicago. It said the Southside fans are with Lajoie in the auto hunt and gave him a hand every time he went to bat. And going into that last series of the season, which Rick will explain the last doubleheader in more depth than I will, is that the paper was aware, at least according to their calculations, that what Knapp needed to do to win the race. And on October 9th, it said, Lajoie's chances of being first in auto race slim. Cleveland player must make a hit nearly every time up in games today. Cobb quits for the season. Cobb actually went off to help the teams going to the World Series practice against an all-star our group. Said, Lajoie's batting slump yesterday when he made only one in hit and four at-bats practically put him out of the race. St. Louis is surely the hoodoo town for Larry, as it was in the city that the Naps managed by him lost the pennant in 1908. Cobb left the Detroit team Friday night, departing for Philadelphia, where he will be a member of the All-Star team that will practice with the Athletics. The Georgian declared that he was not feeling very well. The fact that he was ahead in the auto race and he feared that he might take a slump in the two games yet to be played may have had something to do with his sudden decision. So here we have Rick going into a little more detail about that infamous doubleheader that may or may not have given Knapp the batting title in 1910 and ultimately the Chalmers car.
The Tigers are going into Chicago to play a four-game series with the White Sox. Knapps are going into St. Louis. The Browns were a last-place team owned by Colonel Robert Hedges. They were a pitiful team. Of course, these games were really going to be pretty meaningless. At the time, the Naps were, they were a fifth-place team in 1910, and the Browns were an eighth-place team. Likewise, neither the White Sox or the Tigers were going anywhere in 1910 either. So you've got Cobb in Chicago. He plays the first couple games, and he gets a couple hits. And he decides that he is going to he checks the newspapers there in Chicago. I'm speculating here, but someone told him at least, you've got a pretty good lead here. He decides that he's not going to play the last two games. He thinks he's got the automobile and it's safe, at least in his mind. And he's been invited to play a series of games on an all-star team, prepping the American League champion Philadelphia Athletics. They had clinched by then, prepping them for the 1910 World Series, which would be against the Chicago Cubs. The reason for this these All-Star games were that the leagues did not finish on time. There was a discrepancy. American League finished the season earlier than the National League. So Cobb takes off. It's going to be an automobile drive, I believe. Anyway, he's very secure, circuitous route. But anyway, he ends up in back in the East. And does not play the last two games. Meanwhile, the Naps are in St. Louis. And just to give you a little background, in 1910, the St. Louis Browns won a total of 47 games. They were flat out bad, eighth place. They were managed by a first-year manager named Jack O'Connor. His nicknames were Peach Pie and Rowdy Jack. It's the Rowdy Jack nickname that I think is most apropos. I really had, over his career, had been labeled as one of the dirtiest players in the game. He'd actually played seven seasons in Cleveland. He was a catcher. And he was struggling in his first year of a two-year contract. So as they go into these games, the first couple of games, a few things happen that might raise some eyebrows. But they go into the final day of the season, October 9th, in St. Louis. Attendance throughout the year had been horrible in St. Louis. I think they drew less than 275,000 fans in 1910. They have this final doubleheader of the year, and of course the newspapers have been talking about the race. And an article appears in one of the St. Louis papers that morning that it would take an almost perfect doubleheader for Lajoie to catch and perhaps pass Ty Cobb. Word has probably gotten around by now. Again, I'm only speculating, but a word I think has gotten around that Cobb had taken off. It may not have settled well with some of the players. It certainly may not have settled well with Rowdy Jack O'Connor. So you go into to this doubleheader on the 9th, and I'll just give you a quick rundown on what happened that day. It started out fairly normally. Lajoie came up to bat in the first inning. He took a hard swing and hit a fly ball out to one of the outfielders, a guy named Hub, H-U-B Northern. Hub was a rookie outfielder. It's hard to establish just how good an outfielder he was, but somehow the ball got past him. Some people think it should have been caught. Others thought that he misplayed it. Anyway, it was a hard swing by Lajoie, and he ends up with a triple. Second time he comes up is in the third inning, and he grounds one to shortstop. The Browns shortstop was Bobby Wallace, who later was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame, a terrific fielding shortstop. And somehow or other, Lajoie beat it out for a single. Base hit. Lajoie, not known particularly for his speed, although I do think he was a pretty good base runner. He stole some bases during his career, and he just was not a fast base runner like say an Eddie Collins or a Ty Cobb. Anyway, some people thought that some of the observers at the game thought that Wallace had lobbed the ball over, that it wasn't, he didn't throw it as he normally would, and that allowed Lajoie to beat it out. But anyway, through his first two at-bats, he's He's 2 for 2. Amazingly, there was a crowd of about 8,000 or 9,000 people in the stands, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, crowd of the year, drawn to this totally meaningless game between a fifth and an eighth place a team playing a doubleheader in October, drawn because of the publicity that had been generated and the excitement of this batting race, because this may have made it. Whatever happens in this doubleheader may make a difference in whether or not Cobb gets the automobile or Lash away. So the fans are buzzing and they're cheering and they're very excited about this 2 for 2 day. They're all talking about, could he do it? Can Lashway do it? The third time up is in the fifth inning. And this time, Lashway bunts down to third base and beats out another hit. He's now 3 for 3. But for those observers, especially the sports writers in the stands and the more knowledgeable baseball observers, the third baseman, a fellow named John Red Corridon, a third baseman for the Browns, was playing very, very deep. Sometimes third baseman would play a little deep with Nap Lashway because he was a fierce hitter, hit the ball as hard as anybody in the major leagues, certainly back in 1910. So they would play him a little bit deep, and maybe not that deep. And so there was some buzzing about why would Corridon be that far back. Just a little background on Corridon. He was on October 9th playing in early 20s game. I think he had 22 or 23 games at that point, and only a few of them had been at third base. He'd been brought up from the minor leagues by the Browns and played a few games at shortstop when Bobby Wallace was out with an injury, and then was playing third base on October 9th in this doubleheader. So you could also argue that not being familiar with Lashway and playing third base for one of the first times, that maybe he would play a little bit deeper than the normal player. But maybe not that deep, because the next time up, Lashway again bunts the ball and beats out a hit. He's now 4 for 4. At the end of the first game, the Browns won that first game for those who really are interested in trivia, 5-4. And anyway, so now we're going into the next game, game two. And just to keep this short, Lashway bunts the ball in the first inning when he comes up, the third inning when he comes up, the fifth inning, the seventh inning, and the ninth inning. These are all bunts to third base. And of course, by now, the fans are really buzzing, but they're not buzzing in the same way. There's catcalls. There's some boos in the stand. The people booing, not everybody, but quite a few, was noticeable. And the various sports writers, and there are, keep in mind, several newspapers in St. Louis, these guys are pretty upset. And they're looking at each other and wondering what's going on. The second time up in the in this game, too, actually was a little bit different than the others in that Lashway was actually given a sacrifice. He didn't get a hit that time. There was a man on first base when he bunted. Official score for the St. Louis Republic reporter was the official score for the Browns, actually ruled that was a sacrifice and an error on fumbling the ball. But they gave Lashway the benefit of the doubt. So if you know your scoring, you realize that he did not have a time at bat that time. So he ended up the second game 4 for 4 with a sacrifice. However, during the game, while the game was still in play, the score was approached by a former St. Louis Browns pitcher, now a coach and scout, Harry Howell. Harry was an old spitball pitcher. He went over 100 games. He lost more than he won, though, during his career with the Browns. But he was a very popular player, and they called him Handsome Harry. Very good-looking gentleman. He came up to the press box After that second time at bat, when you'll recall that it was a sacrifice and not a hit ruled by the score, and asked the score if he wouldn't see his way clear to change that to a hit. So you kind of see the drift here and where things are going here. There's an effort on the part of the Browns to give Lajoie a good sending off to the 1910 season. The scorekeeper refused, and Howell left. But then as the second game rolled on, Browns' bat boy or mascot, never was totally sure, but I think it was the bat boy probably. Anyway, he comes up to the scorer's table and hands the official scorer a note. And the note, which apparently was preserved, said that if you see your way clear to change that to a sacrifice to a hit, there'd be a suit of clothes in it for you. So things were getting a little bit out of hand. Again, the scorekeeper turned it down, refused to do it, held fast. And when he sent in his official report, that would be what he said. But an 8-for-8 day had people thinking that maybe Lajoie had just went up to Ty Cobb and won himself a vehicle. Interestingly enough, as it would come out that night, the official scorer received a telephone call from an individual who he assumed was Larry Lajoie, asking him to reconsider, his ruling that was a sacrifice and change it to a base hit. And the man refused. Later, Lajoie admitted that he had made that phone call.
And almost immediately, the newspapers were questioning what had happened. The Plain Dealer on October 10th said, Lajoie wins auto in final stretch by making 8 hits in as many times up. Frenchman passes Cobb. St. Louis papers say Browns made it easy for Knapp's slugger. Unofficial figures show Lajoie ahead from 3 points to a fraction of a point. Official results may not be known for some time. Brown players are charged with not feeling as well as they might and have called the game Hippodrome. Now, the Cleveland Leader actually had their numbers the closest. They added at 382.4 and 381.7, which Lajoie would have had 383 and Cobb 382. And again, the Cleveland papers were great. They were ecstatic for Lajoie. He beat Cobb. You know, mentioned how great this was. The next day, it said Lajoie, the peerless leader, not only Cleveland, but also every baseball city in the United States rejoices that Knapp Lajoie has apparently won the batting championship over Ty Cobb. The reason for this strong partisanship are clear. Lajoie is quite ostentatious and gentlemanly. Cobb is a possessor of reputation for insufferable egotism. It is a small wonder that the sympathy of every baseball enthusiast outside of Detroit is strongly with Lajoie. It has been hinted that the St. Louis third baseman did not make extraordinarily strenuous efforts to field some of the drives in his direction during the final games. That the St. Louis players and audience sympathize strongly with Larry is beyond question, but the mere fact that the third baseman played back for Lajoie, a batsman who usually drives strongly through the infield, does not indicate chicanery or unfair play. At any rate, there was no question as to the legitimacy of the scoring of the hits. The offering of a special prize for the best batting record was a serious mistake. And at this point, Ben Johnson's not thrilled. He says that there will never be another prize played for like this. And even if the assertions prove unfounded, the merest suspicion of crookedness works irreparably injury to the game. Lajoie then said, it's too close for me to claim the victory in the auto. Take it from me, I am waiting until Ben Johnson and Robert McRoy tell me whether I have a better record than Cobb or Cobb has beat me. There is such a difference of opinion that I am not counting my eggs before they are hatched or taking a ride in the auto before Johnson and McRoy have poured in a little Cleveland gasoline. I kind of like that line. They talk about my not earning those 8 hits in St. Louis, though that makes me tired. The first time up, I smashed one to the outfield that went over Northern's head. Yet some say he misjudged it. Then I hit one that Wallace was lucky to knock down. If that wasn't a hit, there never was one. Then we get down to those 6 bunts that I beat out. Suppose Corden didn't play fairly well back. If he had played in for a bunt and I had swung hard on the ball, I suppose the youngster would have been roasted to a turn because he did not play deep. Larry's statement that he had fooled the St. Louis players was born out of the statement made by St. Louis manager O'Connor of the Browns. "Larry outguessed us," said O'Connor. "We figured he did not have the nerve to bunt every time. He beat us at our own game. I will not send any of my players in to play close to Lajoie when he tries the bunt." And by October 13th, the paper said, Ben Johnson may declare Cobb and Lajoie are tied in batting. American League president may order return of the prize auto to the donors because of the dispute which has arisen. Now, by October 16th, Cobb had been declared a batting champion. But nevertheless, both players were going to receive cards. And October 23rd, Larry was noted with his wife. We're going to select his Chalmers model the next day. However, I'm going to let Rick kind of fill in the details a little bit more about the aftermath.
You can only imagine after that doubleheader what some of the St. Louis sports writers wrote about the game. They thought it was a scandal. Any stronger words they could use, they used, because they deplored what they had seen. They felt that that the Browns had thrown the game. A word that was used back in those days, hippodrome, was used, that they had actually laid down for Lajoie to give him an automobile over Cobb. And of course, once those newspapers put out their, those reporters put out their story, those were picked up by all the newspapers in the country, and we had ourselves a full national scandal. And this was all occurring right before baseball's big showpiece, the 1910 World Series, which, of course, Ben Johnson, who was the American League president and also actually the power in baseball at the time. Some people called him the czar of baseball because the National Commission Chairman Herman would vote with Ben Johnson on almost all issues, overruling the National League president if there was any controversy. Well, Ben Johnson did not want the 1910 World Series to be overshadowed by a batting race with an automobile that he and the other commissioners had some qualms about at the start of the year. Of course, Hugh Chalmers was rubbing his hands together. This publicity was like none other. He couldn't have hoped for more publicity, although some of it was turning out to be a little negative. So anyway, Ben Johnson calls several people to come to Chicago, where Ben Johnson's American League offices were, in order to hold a quick investigation and try to put this to rest. The people called in were, first of all, he asked for a report from the home plate umpire, who was Billy Evans at the time, and he asked for a report from Evans. That report is unavailable. I wish I could have gotten to it when I was researching for the book, but no one knows if one still exists. It's certainly not available. The report supposedly, according to newspaper reports, cleared the Browns of any wrongdoing. Of course, when you analyze this, they were clear bunts. The umpire could only call what he sees on the field, although Evans did say that he felt that he saw some fielding miscues that he questioned on the second game of the series, the day before the October 9th doubleheader, that he did question, but he couldn't do anything about it, but it did raise suspicion. Anyway, so his report apparently did not find any fault. As it turns out, the others called in were Jack O'Connor, the manager of the Browns, Red Corydon, the rookie third baseman, and Harry Howell, the former pitcher, now scout, who came up to the press box during the game. They were all called in. Meetings were held in secret. And Van Johnson also ordered McCroy, his league secretary, to do a very quick calculation and see what the final results were of the batting race. So Van Johnson comes out in front of a gaggle of reporters, says that he finds no fault, that the doubleheader was above board, clears everybody of any possible wrongdoing, and declares Ty Cobb has won the race by the narrowest of margins. He has a 385 average rounded off, and Lajoie was at 384-1. So Ty Cobb is the batting champ, and they can now move on to the 1910 World Series. However, when Jack O'Connor and Harry Howell got back to St. Louis, Robert Hedges, the Browns president, majority stockholder, fires both of them. O'Connor still had a year to go in his contract, but the two of them were fired. Red Corydon was not disciplined in any fashion, and they moved on with this. Interestingly enough, seven or eight Tigers players telegrammed Lajoie before the Van Johnson ruling, congratulations on winning the car, and were very congratulatory towards Lajoie. Not upset that their teammate Cobb looked like he was going to lose out on the car. But as it turned out, Cobb was the winner. Hugh Chalmers, never to look another publicity coup in the eye, decides he's going to award a vehicle to both Cobb and Lajoie. Cobb picked up his vehicle at the 1910 World Series. Lajoie, I believe he might have picked his up when the Reds and the Nats were playing their interleague series. So basically, that's where the story of 1910 ends, but it doesn't really end there. And that's what makes this, to me, very, very interesting story.
And this is where it gets really interesting, is when someone went back to look at the numbers and calculate everything, they discovered that, wait a second, Cobb had two extra hits that he never actually earned.
In 1981, now we're talking about 71 years, something was found out. And interestingly enough, in the interim of that, there had been a lawsuit filed by Jack O'Connor, and it was filed in St. Louis, and he was trying to get his job back and also get damages for missing out on the second year of his contract. I was able to locate the transcript of that trial. It went to trial and get the testimony. Van Johnson testified by way of deposition. Robert Hedges testified. A number of the players testified. Jack O'Connor testified. It made for fascinating reading. But again, there was no way to definitively prove that. Even though they accused Jack O'Connor of telling Corydon to play way back and allow for the bunting that went on, they weren't able to really prove anything. And O'Connor won his second year of the contract. I think it was $5,000, and his expenses of the lawsuit went up on appeal and was upheld on appeal. So now we're in 1981, and a member of the Society for American Baseball Research and one of the top early sabermetrics individuals, a sabermetrician, Pete Palmer, is doing some work tabulating to come up with some of the early statistics that are being used in some of the baseball encyclopedias that are coming out. He comes upon the 1910 Tigers records, and he's looking through Ty Cobb's day by days. If you recall earlier in our conversation, this is the record kept by the league secretary, Rob McCroy, where he jots down each day's statistics as turned in by the official scorekeeper, in this case with the St. Louis Republic. And he finds that there is an error, that there had been a doubleheader played on September 24th of 1910, and McCroy had only entered one of the games. And then he did, there was a single game on the 25th, and he entered the game twice. So he had actually corrected his mistake unknowingly by, or maybe knowingly, just didn't go back and change the dates. But there was an extra game. But in going through the records in a big hurry, to his defense, as directed by Ban Johnson, to come up with the final statistics for the batting race. Because actually, these were done over a longer period of time and not released for several weeks after the season. But here they had to come up with this before the start of the World Series. He had re-entered that September 24th game because he looked at it and probably saw that he had not put in the second game. As it turned out, that gave Ty Cobb an extra two hits in four times at bat. And when you take that out of the equation, the actual figures now favor, drop Cobb down and favor Lajoie as the fellow with the top average in the big leagues. He actually, Cobb's actual average was 383.4, while Cobb's was 338.41. So Cobb was Lajoie was the actual winner of the batting race by statistics as counted by later corrected score day by day sheets.
And there you have the story of the Chalmers race. And if you want a more in-depth look at it, Rick's book is fantastic. I would highly suggest picking that up if you're looking for a read, or I guess there's still time maybe to get Christmas presents. So that will be it, I think, for the rest of this year. I'm going to take some time off. So until next year, thank you for listening to the podcast, Our Tribe History, presented by Progressive, and have a great holiday season.
To Our Tribe History, presented by Progressive, with your host, Indians team historian Jeremy Fedor.